Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone. I'm Stephen Carter, your host for this week's episode. And I recently read a book called Cultish by Amanda Montell. Because, you know, I've always been intrigued by cults. Who isn't, really? When I was a kid, you know, I'd imagine cults in dark rooms filled with people in robes, droning in a weird language as they lurked around candles, with Enigma playing in the background. So it was pretty funny to me when I heard that evangelical Christians considered Mormonism a cult. I was like, have they ever attended a Mormon sacrament meeting? Church was about the furthest thing from a cult I could imagine. And of course, in popular culture, cults are usually portrayed as an isolated group of people in the desert or in the mountains. And because they're isolated, they can build up their unique worldview. And as long as their group survives, their worldview seems justified to them. However, Cultish was published in 2020. And Montell dedicates most of her book to showing that many current cults actually get a great deal of their power from how interconnected our society is today. She was like finding cults on YouTube and Instagram. So I'll admit, while I was reading this book, I was wondering, am I part of a cult? And as it turns out, yes. And not just Mormonism, which I still believe is the world's most boring cult. Being the English major I am, the most interesting thing about the book is encapsulated in its subtitle, which is The Language of Fanaticism. So, Montell isn't interested in how cults isolate themselves physically. She's interested in how they do it linguistically. Here's one of the things she says, quote, "From the redefinition of existing words and the invention of new ones, to powerful euphemisms, secret codes, renamings, buzzwords, chants and mantras, speaking in tongues, forced silences, even hashtags, language is the key means by which all degrees of cult-like influence occur," unquote. Now, this seems rather frightening, because we all use language. In fact, it's essential to the way we work as a larger culture. We need language to communicate and keep this extraordinarily complex society we have running. In fact, language is at the root of our civilization. Without that shared symbolism, we wouldn't be able to do much at all. But it seems to me that we need to stop here for just a minute. I've been treating the word cult as if it signifies something bad. But isn't a cult just like a small, new, highly focused culture? Isn't it just a motivated group that hasn't gone mainstream yet? Maybe it would be helpful to remove the stigma from cult for just a minute and look at it objectively. I mean, what do we even mean when we say cult? Let me give you a few examples of possible cults so that we can start thinking about a definition. One of the most interesting classes I took during my undergrad was the literary criticism course. I know, kind of a surprise, right? But the professor took us through a number of critical approaches, like New Criticism, which is like really old. It was developed in the 1930s or something. Is that old? Anyway, Freudianism, Feminism, Marxism, Structuralism, and since we are in the English literature world, Post-Structuralism. So as we surveyed each of these approaches, we looked at how each lens would affect our reading of a particular story. I don't actually remember which one it was. Probably something like A Rose for Emily or something. So with each approach, we learned a different set of words to navigate a text by. We redefined certain words. We made different assumptions about what was important to find in a text. and then the text would shift accordingly. In other words, we were doing precisely what Montel was saying in that earlier quote. We were redefining existing words. We were inventing, or at least learning, new words. We were establishing secret codes. We were renaming things. We were making new buzzwords, chants, and mantras. But sadly, no candles or enigma in the background. And when we finished that class, we had the beginnings of 5 new languages under our belts. And with them, we could alter any creative work at will. We could even read life through these new lenses if we wanted to. So was that a cult? Here's another one. When my daughter was young, I was looking around for a preschool to put her in, but I was a little slow, and the only preschool I could find that was still enrolling students was at a dance studio. So dance classes were a part of her day there, and she turned out to be kind of good at it. So she started taking dance classes at the studio. Then she joined a dance team, which would go to competitions. And then she started doing solos at those competitions. As I said, she was a natural, and she practiced hard, and she actually kind of won just about everything. It was really exciting. I'll admit this. More adrenaline pumped through my veins during those years than ever before or ever since. But then, I started noticing how expensive dance was. People who have kids in dance are laughing at me right now. See, when you're on a team, it costs hundreds of dollars each month for the classes. And then there are the costume fees, the competition fees, the convention fees, the studio fees. It was amazing how much it cost. I mean, if you calculated how much money went into a single competition performance, it was in the thousands of dollars. I'm not exaggerating. So these dancers poured hundreds of hours, and their parents poured thousands of dollars into this very ephemeral art form. And I really have to say, the dances were beautiful. I'll admit that I would frequently weep while I was watching them. It was expensive, but boy, was it gorgeous. And to have your kid be a part of that beauty? It was amazing. But then I noticed something else. The only people who saw these dances were the dancers' families. See, when the studio would have their showcase, it wasn't like the population of Utah Valley bought up the tickets and turned out en masse to see the performance. It was us, the parents, who bought the tickets. And then the same people who saw the dances at the competitions would see them one more time at the showcase. The fact that the audience for these exquisite dances was so small was really brought home to me when, cue my parental pride, my daughter won a national championship with her solo. I was ready to field calls from agents and news reporters. I was certain we were going to be on television. This was a big deal. But don't laugh. Not a single phone call or email came my way. So, here we have a small community where people pour hundreds of hours and thousands of dollars into beautiful dances that almost no one sees. Was that dance studio a cult? It does fit some criteria from Montel. Cults provide meaning, purpose, a sense of community, and ritual. But the value they create has very little weight in the larger world. But before we make our final decision on whether these were cults, let's consider one more thing. Of course, cult is the root word for culture. A culture is a set of values that, as Montel points out, we create through language. We use those values to dictate behavior, to make the community stick together and to make meaning out of life. Basically, culture is one of our most powerful tools for survival, because a coherent community with shared values where every person feels that their life is meaningful, it works together well, which increases the community's chance for survival. So cultures are a technology we developed for survival. And along with that survival comes meaning. In a healthy culture, survival and meaning are both in balance. They work with each other. So with that in mind, here's one more example. It's from a novel I read called The Proper Gods by Virginia Sorensen. You're right, good memory. I talked about her novel Kingdom Come in my previous episode. Her work has a way of sticking with me. So, this novel takes place in the 1950s, and it's about a Mexican Indian named Aiden, who goes back to his ancestral country in the Sonoran Desert after being in the U.S. Army. He's never actually lived in his ancestral home, and he finds out very quickly that it has a very strict culture. During his first day at the village, he talks to a girl his age, and a man nearby knocks him to the ground and lets him know that talking to a girl that you're not related to is against the law, duh. In fact, Aiden is put on trial for his misdeed. As time goes on, he realizes how at odds his people are with the surrounding Mexican culture. For example, his village refuses irrigation services from the government. It also refuses electricity. And there's this plant called cane, which grows naturally and abundantly on their land, and it's an easily sellable cash crop on the border. They could make money off of just harvesting what naturally grows there. But there's a taboo against it. So they basically scratch out a subsistence lifestyle. But the one thing that the village seems to have plenty of are the many rituals that make up village life. There are so many rituals that one character actually observes that there's always a ritual to lose a job for, but not always a job to lose. But Aiden starts to notice that these rituals make his life feel more meaningful. Toward the middle of the book, Aiden joins a group of men who spend a considerable amount of time and effort to ritually prepare the village for its largest festival. In fact, it takes so much work that Aiden's family's crops start to fail. And this is especially worrying because his sister's baby daughter is starting to get sick, and the infant mortality rate in the village is quite high because they're averse to taking in anything from outside, including medicine. So one night, during a week when field work is taboo, he sneaks out to take care of his field. And one of his fellows catches him there and puts him in the stockades, where he stays for like 3 or 4 days. The burden of living in the village, especially its circumscribed opportunities for women, actually becomes too great for Aiden's youngest sister, and she marries a Mexican, which is, as you might imagine, taboo, and moves to another town. Aiden's older sister, who has a sick baby, she moves out of the village too, in hopes of finding some medicine. The book ends with Aiden trapped in the bind of whether to live a life full of ritual meaning, but material poverty, or less meaning and a bigger chance at affluence. I'm not going to tell you which one he chooses. So here's the question. Even though this village is a culture, is it also a cult? One thing that a culture is supposed to do is to make your life meaningful. But I'll have to admit that for the most part, American culture has become really bad at that. I mean, the most meaning you can usually squeeze out of your job is, I get paid. And if you leave Mormonism and its theology along with it, you suddenly have to find something else that gives your life meaning. But, you know, a lot of ex-Mormons feel like they were duped when they were believers. And that makes it very difficult for them to believe any other kind of theology. If it sounds like magic, it is magic. Or you just have to go out and make meaning for yourself, which is a huge amount of work. So, especially in today's American culture, one of the things that draws us toward a cult is the blossoming of meaning. How do so many of our movies go? A normal person stumbles onto an amazing truth that transforms their life and sends them on an exciting, meaningful journey. Luke Skywalker and Neo, right? Suddenly, things that were onerous or mundane, they take on a new life. Everything connects, and the protagonist gains either literal or metaphorical superpowers. At heart, I think all of us believe that we are the protagonist of that narrative. We all believe that there's something special about us. And if that belief dribbles away, so does the meaning in our lives. But if we meet someone who sees our specialness, creates an opportunity for us, a mentor who points us toward an exciting journey, suddenly we light up again. It's like falling in love. And then we get to learn secret knowledge. We get to be part of a mission-driven community. We get to have contact with charismatic people. We get to feel, I don't know, secure in the world again. And that is what a culture is supposed to give you. But a culture is also supposed to provide survival. And I think that this is where you start finding the difference between a culture and a cult. A culture balances survival and meaning. A cult prioritizes meaning over survival. Montel brings up a few examples of how this happens. For example, Scientology apparently has many levels that its adherents move through as they progress through their system. And each level requires mental and emotional work, learning esoteric concepts, and a fee. So as you reach the higher levels, the fee also rises. And Montel quotes some people who says that the all-consuming study and social commitment added to the rising fees eventually overbalanced the good that they used to get out of Scientology. So, meaning significantly outweighed survival. Something similar happened with my daughter and dance. There eventually came a point where the amount of commitment she had to put into it outweighed the meaning that she received from it. So after a lot of talking and a lot of tears, she didn't take her spot on the dance team a few years ago. The interesting thing about everything that happened there was how much her quitting affected me. I was the main guy who brought her to dance, who set up her private lessons, who brought her to competitions, who put on her makeup, who did her hair, who did all the behind-the-scenes work, and there was a lot of it. But the thing is, all of that, it gave me a really strong identity. It was one that I never would have predicted for myself, which was Dance Dad. And most of my friends were the other parents of dancers. So when she quit, I went through this huge identity crisis. I suddenly didn't have access to a bunch of my friends, and I lost all of my energy. I would just sit there on the couch for like a week. And I'll admit it, I even cried kind of frequently. It may sound dumb to you. It would have sounded dumb to me, but it's true. I guess you could say that I had the resources to continue in the dance culture. It gave me a lot of meaning, and the meaning wasn't heavier than survival. But the same wasn't true for my daughter, and she was the one doing the dancing. So I guess that brings us back around to the question of, was this dance community a cult? And I guess I'd say that for my daughter, it became a cult. And that for me, it wasn't. And I'd say that it was very much the same for the various characters in The Proper Gods. For some of them, the meaning the village culture provided was not too heavy to bear. It didn't sap away too much of their lives or resources. But for others, they finally had to leave in order to maintain themselves. So what about that literary criticism class? I guess it wasn't a cult at the time, but I have to admit, we were involved in a very strange type of program. I mean, I'd say that my life is definitely richer and more soulful because of my literary education, and yes, it has given me tools that I can indirectly apply to a lot of different situations. But being a writer and an editor, I'm one of very few people from my various programs who actually uses my degree. And I'm convinced that I just got lucky. But for most of my program colleagues, they're doing things that have little to do with their degrees. And a lot of them went deeply into debt to get that education. In fact, one of my friends was kind of running away from her previous student debt by continually getting into new degree programs, which of course only dug her in deeper. So in a way, that class, that program, might be called a cult, but, you know, one whose costs didn't become apparent until after its lifespan was over. So I guess what I'm getting at is that saying that a group is a cult isn't quite accurate. You could definitely say that a group has a higher or lower potential for being a cult, but the cult aspect of the group seems to reside in the relationship between the person and the group. If the group is providing a balance of value and survival to you, then you are in a cultural relationship. But if the group's demands for maintaining meaning outweigh its survival offerings to you, then you are in a cult relationship. So maybe it's not useful to wonder if we're in a cult. Maybe it's more useful to wonder whether we are culting. Culting. Is that a word? It sounds like clubbing, except you go around to different cults, some of whom wear robes and play Enigma in the background, and some of whom wear Speedos and play Opeth in the background. Culting, I guess, is when we believe, but we believe to our spiritual, emotional, physical, and mental detriment. When maintaining meaning has become so heavy that it detracts from our ability to live. And I think that we've all culted at one point or another in our lives, like when your family is way overburdened with church callings. I might even go out on a limb here and say that child rearing lends itself easily to culting. It takes so much these days to raise a child the way our culture tells us we should. So much time, so much money, so much worrying about what other people think or about preparing our children for the future. It takes so much. But what comes back to maintain us? So anyway, we've been talking all of this time as if culting only affects individuals, as if the consequences of culting only affect the person who is doing the culting. But I get the feeling that cultures can cult too. I get this feeling from watching what is going on politically in the good old US of A right now. If there's one thing that seems to characterize our discourse, it's that it's chock full of cults. Cults in the way that Montel is talking about. These are groups that redefine words or make up new words. new euphemisms, secret codes, buzzwords, chants, and mantras, they're all popping up, even those forced silences she was talking about, and it's happening on both ends of the political spectrum. And through the magic of the internet, these new cults can develop so rapidly, with so many spin-off cults, that anyone who isn't spending a lot of time trying to keep up absolutely will not keep up. And woe betide those who are not even aware that these cults are developing, for they shall be confounded when they accidentally incur their wrath. But it still bugs me to call them cults. It's just too charged of a word. It's too hard to get past the negative connotations. I'm thinking that it would be more useful to call them high-stakes causes, because the root of these high-stakes causes is that they're addressing something that is high stakes. A religious cult, or high-stakes cause, presents itself as the only thing between you and eternal damnation, and that's high stakes. A political cult represents itself as the only thing between you and, for example, the destruction of the nation, or the violation of children, or rampant persecution, or mass death. They are causes that address hugely weighty issues, so weighty that they seem to be the most important thing. I admit that high-stakes cause is three syllables instead of one, and it doesn't really roll off the tongue the way cult does. But I think it's less charged and more useful. So the interesting thing about these political cults, or high-stakes causes, is how deeply they're based on a meaning that feels theological. When you talk with their adherents about their beliefs, it sounds like they're bearing their testimony. I mean, they get teary-eyed, or they get full of righteous rage. They use us versus them language. They frame the world as a moral battle, a battle that brooks no compromise. And it must be won at all costs, because it's high stakes. It's funny, I actually feel really uncomfortable naming any movements as high stakes causes, because when you invoke their names, you suddenly become involved with their high stakes. I guess the only thing I'm really willing to say is, if an argument about something has cooled a friendship or a family relationship, it's a high-stakes cause, and you're involved with it. If you have convictions about it, it's a high-stakes cause. Now, we did make a distinction between cults and culting earlier, and I think it's important to apply that distinction here. Likely, we who are involved with these high-stakes causes are getting the meaning and the survival aspects we need out of our involvement. We ourselves are not culting. But I want to argue that the profusion of high-stakes causes and the energy we put into maintaining and promoting them has led us to a stage where we, as a country, are culting. Collectively, we put so much energy and resources into meaning that it's draining our ability to live. We're writing theology while our families starve. Our belief is outstripping our resources. We can see it happening all around us. But we're unwilling to stop culting because it isn't hurting us personally at the moment. In fact, we still get an invigorating sense of meaning out of our causes. So, are you and I adding to this mass culting? I think that there are questions we can ask ourselves to find out. One is, can we empathize with our political opponents? Can we see the world from their perspective and understand, rationally and emotionally, why they feel the way they do? If we can't, I think we're culting. Here's another question. Do we get a charge out of being right? If so, I think we're culting, because we've built our own moral system and we've cut out the possibility that other systems may have any value. Here's another. Do we feel interested or do we feel attacked when we come across a point of view different from ours? If we feel attacked, I think we're culting. If we find out that someone holds a particular political view, or if that person makes a statement that we vigorously disagree with, does that suddenly overshadow our entire perception of that person? If so, I think we're culting. Here's one final question. Do we have contempt for our opponents? If we do, I really do think we're culting, and that's the hardest one for me to swallow. But I think it's actually the most important one. Did you ever hear about the Gottman Institute study about contempt in marriage? They did this study with hundreds of married couples and found that they could predict with a high degree of accuracy which couples would divorce within the next 5 years. And there was just one criterion they had to find. Contempt. When you have contempt for each other, so much hurt or misunderstanding has built up between you that you've given up on communicating. Really, the only interactions you have left are sarcasm, insults, and assertions of the other person's inferiority. You know, the Venn diagram of the two of you shows a smaller and smaller shared area until it disappears. And that's kind of what it looks like in America. A shrinking Venn diagram. The definition of me is the lack of you. But here's a question. What kind of person do you end up being if you try to remove yourself from culting? It's kind of difficult to imagine, especially since our main sources of imagination are the stories that we find in movies and television. Because here's the funny thing, I'm going to let you in on a little narrative secret. Stories are often cults. Because see, they create a moral universe that has boundaries, and they show how good triumphs over evil. So, there are, you know, the Rebel Forces and the Empire, or Bond and Dr. No. In other words, the hero and the villain. Most popular stories, go ahead, think back through them, have a black and white, cultic worldview. That's why they're so much fun! You get an exciting dose of meaning without any sacrifice. And then the cult ends, and you can get on with your life. So, while I sit here talking about how often we cult, probably the first story that comes to your mind is the one about how the character with no convictions finally sees the light and fights for justice. Am I trying to convince you to be that tepid, convictionless person? Let me answer you with a slightly modified quote from E.M. Forrester. Quote, "Personal relations are despised today. They are regarded as products of a time of fair weather, which is now past, and we're urged to get rid of them, and to dedicate ourselves to some movement or cause instead. If I had to choose between betraying my cause and betraying my friend, I hope I should have the guts to betray my cause." Unquote. I think Forrester is pointing us towards something we desperately need. Friends! We need friends more than we need causes right now. Human warmth will do more for this country at this moment than causes. A good friendship can help remind us that causes were made for man, not man for causes. Here's a little more from Forrester. Quote, "I believe in aristocracy, Not an aristocracy of power based on rank and influence, but an aristocracy of the sensitive, the considerate, and the plucky. Its members are to be found in all nations and classes and throughout the ages. And there's a secret understanding between them when they meet. They represent the true human condition, the one permanent victory of our queer race over cruelty and chaos. Thousands of them perish in obscurity. A few are great names. They're sensitive for others as well as for themselves. They're considerate without being fussy. Their pluck is not swankiness, but the power to endure. And they can take a joke. Unquote. I really like that last part. They can take a joke. Not make a joke, take a joke. To me, the ability to take a joke is the ultimate indicator that you are not culting. Most jokes can be summarized as, "See how I'm right?" So they can easily be an assertion of the joke teller's superiority, which is a manifestation of cultic thinking. However, jokes also unintentionally expose the power structure that the joke teller sees. And that's really useful when you have someone in the room who can take a joke. To take a joke means that you have the ability to roll with someone else's humorous assertion of superiority and then stay in non-judgmental relationship with them long enough after the punchline that the joke and the joker get a little more time to breathe. When they see that for you, the joke wasn't an affirmation or a negation of your relationship, the boundaries of the joke can dissipate between you. "I'm here with you," you're saying. The joke, or the cause, is not what connects or separates us. But hey, let's talk about it. When you can take a joke, jokes change from a boxing match to a dance. For example, I had a friend, a playwright named Eric Samuelson, who never saw a bad movie in his life. It wasn't that he only watched critically acclaimed movies. It was that his interaction with any movie was always generous and interesting. He wasn't asking, "Is this a good movie or a bad movie?" He was asking, "What interesting directions can we go from here?" I think that's kind of what taking a joke constitutes. You're sidestepping the drama. You're not getting pulled into judgment, into cultic thinking. Instead, you're creating a space where people can see each other beyond their high-stakes causes. Our mistake is when we mistake causes for relationships. On they go, an invincible army, yet not a victorious one, Forster writes. The aristocrats, the elect, the chosen, the best people, all the words that describe them are false. And all attempts to organize them fail. They slip through the net and are gone. When the door is shut, they're no longer in the room. Their temple, as one of them remarked, is the holiness of the heart's affections. And their kingdom, though they never possess it, is the wide open world. Unquote. All attempts to organize these people fail. I think it's because they've practiced escaping cultic thinking, escaping the confines of the drama. They've discovered that the world is far larger and much more interesting than those narrow paths. Well, there you have it. My answer to America's political problems. Make a friend. Or deepen a friendship, preferably with someone you don't always agree with. Give yourself a chance to betray your cause for a friend. It might be fun. Well, thanks for joining me for the Sunstone podcast. Usually at this point, I remind you to go to sunstone.org/registration to register for our symposium app, where you can get access to all of our 2021 Sunstone Summer Symposium audio. but you're probably sick of hearing that, so I won't say it. Instead, I look forward to talking with you in the next episode. Take care.